This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Our guest today is from the Grand Canyon Institute, and Dave Wells specifically is research director of that organization. And we're going to talk about some policy research. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, for openers, what is the Grand Canyon Institute?
So the Grand Canyon Institute is a nonprofit think tank. We're centrist. What we're trying to do in Arizona, we were founded in 2011, and we try to bring more facts to the degree we pay attention to facts and information so people can be more informed about policy choices so we can make the best use of our tax money and try to make Arizona a better place for everybody.
Partisan, nonpartisan?
We're nonpartisan, and we have a board. We were founded in part by George Cunningham, who was the deputy chief of staff for Governor Napolitano, and then also a number of moderate Republican legislators, such as Susan Girard and the late Carolyn Allen. And so we have this nice sort of balanced, very thoughtful board.
Yeah, full disclosure, I'm one of them, so my affiliation is up front out there. However, we're going to talk about a number of research projects, and I will say that while I've read most of these, I did not have a hand in their production. They were generally yours, in some cases with some others, but
right.
Just to be up front about that. All right. We're going to talk about two things today. Most of our discussion is going to be about charter schools, because you've done a lot of work on charter schools. And we're not going to so much focus on, well, this was this report and this was that report. I think that's too in the weeds for more people, but really go at it by topic. And then later on in our fourth segment, we're going to talk about unemployment compensation. And you did a recent report on that as well. Just for our openers, just in case we don't lose anybody here. What exactly is a charter school?
So a charter school is a public school that is privately operated. So essentially the government contracts with a private entity to provide a public education. That's different from a private school. So a charter school has to follow, they can't discriminate on who can be enrolled there. They have to follow the same state curricular guidelines, as opposed to a private school, which doesn't have to follow the state curricular guidelines and has some latitude where they can discriminate if they're a religious school or based on academics on certain criteria.
So a charter school cannot be a religious school.
Now they can't be teaching a religious curriculum, no. And so there are some that, I mean, if they have any connection with a church, they've got to really separate it because they've got to follow the state standards.
Okay, so these are publicly funded but contracted by, it's your tax dollars that are paying for these.
That's right. And Arizona has the highest percentage of children in charter schools of any state in the country.
What's the story? How'd they come about?
Well,
because they haven't been here for that long.
So it happened when Jeff Flake was head of the Goldwater Institute, that they were pushing a school choice agenda. In the beginning part of it included—
When you hear the discussion about school choice, they're usually talking about charter schools.
Right. It started with charter schools, and we also have subsidies for private schools, which came out shortly thereafter. So charter schools were I think really came a lot out of the Goldwater Institute. They were big proponents of it, still are big proponents of it.
It's part of the privatization movement, really.
Right.
We can take government functions and have private entities do it better because government can't do it right. So goes the theory.
That's right. So that happened in the sort of mid 90s, and at that time, the Republic's done some stories about the history of them. Yeah, they weren't really quite sure how they were going to do things and so forth. But we've got actual major. Large charter corporations that is their business that they're in. Some of them are just in Arizona and some of them are in multiple states. And so it's more of a big business now, not simply a mom and pop operation.
How many kids in Arizona are in charter schools versus traditional public schools?
So there are about 200,000 children in charter schools, and there are about 1 million or kids in district schools.
So it's a tad under 20% of the total enrollment. This is not a small experiment. This is a major undertaking.
Right. And if you measure it in the context of growth, charter schools have been very successful. So the actual growth in district school enrollment has been pretty flat, and whereas charter school enrollment has continued to rise.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the financial arrangement. How does that work? Somebody says they want to start this school. How do they do it? How do they go about getting a contract and getting student? How does that actually function?
So in Arizona, there are essentially two authorizers for charter schools that we have for the most part. Most of them go through the Arizona State Board for charter schools. And then you also may, listeners may be aware that Arizona State University is also sponsoring some charter schools. We don't focus a lot on the ASU charter schools in our reports, but so most of them go through the Arizona State Board for charter schools. They have to get accepted by them.
What do they have to demonstrate?
They have to develop an educational plan and have it approved, and it's become now they have to also have to put forward about $6,000 as a fee to do that. It used to be much smaller than that, but they have to show that they and convince the board that they actually have a sufficient plan to have a good school. Now, some number of them don't last that long. Over time, we've had almost half of the schools eventually close, but overall, we have.
Have we had issues of them closing in the middle of the year?
Yeah, a couple years ago, they happened. We had a couple that really were highlighted a lot. There was the Bradley Cremos Discovery Academy, where the person who was running the school was actually inflating the number of kids there so he could essentially steal money from the state. He got in criminal troubles for that. And we had Starshine Academy, which was bankrupt. And because the bankruptcy judge, which is through the U.S. Department of Justice, had identified some questionable expenses, which included a trip to Hawaii and so forth, that the charter board then got more on them and closed them down.
Now, how do they get their money? In other words, do they get it lump sum at the beginning of the year if somebody closes, or do they get it monthly or apportioned? By what sequence are they paid?
So they get paid monthly. So and it is based on their enrollment. Charter schools have they have a cap on how many students they can have, a maximum, and then they can apply to have the cap increased. But they're like district schools in that sense. They get paid on a monthly basis. And what's different about where the funds come from? District schools get a combination of funds that some come from your local property taxes, and some will come from the state, depending on how affluent or how poor the area is, whereas charter schools get all of their money from the state. None of it comes from property taxes. So in that sense, they've become an increasingly a strain on the state budget, because there's only so much, even though we think we have a lot of money in the state budget, there's only so much there. And when they have to give, when there's growth and it has to all come from the state, that has put a little bit of strain on the budget.
Now, I know there's a lot of controversy about this in terms of how are various things counted, but overall, what is the level of funding per student for somebody in a charter school versus a public school?
So our analysis,
a traditional public school.
So our analysis of it is they're about the same. You'll often hear people from the charter school community say they get funded less, so there's a base state formula that's sort of complicated and so forth. And on top of that, charter schools get what's called charter additional assistance. And that was generally designed because they're not able to bond the way district schools can to build schools. Whereas district schools get that same base amount of money, and they get a smaller amount that Governor Ducey this year will hopefully get fully funded, but still about $1,500 less per student than what charter schools get. But then the district schools do have the ability to bond and so forth. But
so who gets $1,500 less?
District schools.
District
do.
Schools get $1,500.
But when we put it everything together, right, and you look at see what how it works out, the school, all the schools right now in Arizona are probably getting in the neighborhood of about, and again, there's a lot of variability across charters and also district schools, but I would say roughly $8,500 for a regular education child.
Right. Now, are most of the charter schools, are they actually building schools, or they're just renting space somewhere?
It depends, but a lot of them are, again, what we're seeing now is consolidation in the market. So almost all of the growth is happening with these larger, bigger players, mm-hmm. Which might include like American Leadership Academy, Basis, and Great Hearts. And what we see with them is they generally Sometimes you'd see a school lease initially, but a lot of times now they're building, especially on the periphery, like of Maricopa County, mm-hmm. where the growth is at. That's essentially what's happening now, is there's a little bit less leasing and a lot more purchasing.
All right. We've set the context. We will return with Dave Wells in just a minute, talk about some of the findings that they've had looking at the financial arrangements and other things and performance as well within charter schools versus traditional public schools. When we return in the Think Tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back here with Dr. Dave Wells. He is the research director of the Grand Canyon Institute, a Phoenix-based nonpartisan think tank. They've done a lot of work on charter schools. I wonder if you could start out and tell us some of the issues you found, particularly in terms of financial accountability.
Yeah, so we've been trying to improve the financial accountability and transparency. In fact, a lot of elected officials, when they were running last election cycle, were running on that in part because of the work we've been doing. Now, so one of the areas we're looking at is related parties. And just to explain what a related party is say you own a charter school, or say we both own a charter school, and then but we decide we'll also form a side company and we'll do business with it. Because charter schools don't have to do a competitive bid process. District schools, if the contract's over $50,000, they have to go through a competitive bid process. As charter schools don't. So that gives us the ability to contract with ourselves. So that's we have a conflict of interest in doing that. So we have a concern of making sure that public tax dollars...
And that's okay? That's legal to do in the case of a charter school?
Right. Completely legal for a charter school. And you may remember the CFO for the Scottsdale Unified School District and how much trouble she got into because they were doing a contract with a firm that her sister and she had been involved
in. And that's a no-no because it's a traditional public school.
Right. So she got in all kinds of trouble.
But in a charter school, that's no problem.
That's completely fine. If she had done that with a charter school, it would have been completely legal. That's one of the concerns we generally have. That's why we want to have more transparency mm-hmm. for it. We want to know that they're actually not bilking taxpayers by jacking up prices.
Well, and I mean, just obvious to me from the get-go on that is, okay, you've run the school is quote unquote nonprofit, but you contract out some major function for most of the money to this other entity, which may be you or your sister-in-law or somebody related to you at a possibly inflated price. We don't know whether it's inflated because it's not competitively bid, and that entity can make all the money in the world.
Yeah, and that's how it works. And nonprofit status is one of the things that we're quite concerned about, because most charter schools are formally nonprofit, but they often have relationships with a related party for-profit entity. And listeners may remember that the Trump Foundation got in all kinds of trouble for essentially using the nonprofit's money and then giving it to the Trump company.
Oh, yeah. They had a nonprofit, and then they had a golf tournament or something, and huge money went into the golf resort, which is for profit.
Right. And you're not allowed to do those things.
That's under federal law, right?
That's federal law. And so there's what we think is a blatant violation of federal law, for instance, with Primavera. Primavera was a nonprofit and decided to transfer their charter to Damian Creamer's for-profit. He's controlling the nonprofit. And you're actually not allowed to do that. If you have a nonprofit status, you can sell it at fair market value, which they could have done, but they didn't. They just gave it away to him. And then you would have to give the proceeds of the sale to another nonprofit. That's, if you're a charity, that's what you're supposed
sure,
to do.
Sure, nonprofit owns something. The hospitals, St. Luke's, I think, mm-hmm. did that. They sold their hospital. Mm-hmm. To a profit-making company, and then the proceeds went into the St. Luke's Foundation.
Yeah, that would
perfectly
be
legitimate, because the proceeds are still there for a charitable purpose.
Right, and that's what you're supposed to do. Primavera didn't do that. It's in their audit. We still are confused. This happened in 2015. Why nobody's blown the whistle on it?
Isn't that a federal issue?
It's a federal issue. I don't know to what degree it's also a state issue, because they're avoiding state taxes,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, both.
And,
yes.
So We think it should be investigated quite clearly, because what happens next year is Primavera makes $10 million in profits, and that's primarily benefiting Damian Creamer, who already had issues because he was already sending a lot of money to another for-profit that was providing the software. So we think that's the most blatant example of a violation or likely violation of a 501c3 status. But there are lots of other ones which haven't done that. They just simply contract a lot. So Arizona Connections Academy, which is an online charter school, and a lot of them, the online ones are the ones that we have some of the greatest concerns about. They're actually owned by Pearson. So Pearson's a large educational for-profit, and 96% of the dollars that go into the nonprofit go into the for-profit.
So that's basically a sham deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you got this. If they're getting 96% of the money, for all intents, it's going to them.
Yeah, and we think that's also a clear violation of what 501c3 status is. You're not allowed to, even if it's a fair price, you're not allowed to essentially, as a for-profit entity, benefit from it beyond anything that's incidental to running the school. And when you purposely structure it this way, you're actually...
We got to just quick an ending question. Is this an inadequacy of the laws that were involved in setting it up, or is it strictly that they're not being enforced?
It's enforcement. Like, the IRS is not enforcing this law, and I think the state needs to step up with it. Well, they lost a lot of auditors back in the early 2010s because they were accused of investigating too many conservative organizations.
So they basically are reduced capacity to handle.
Yeah, and we think the state needs to step up to sort of help them out.
Okay, we'll return with Dave Wells talking Arizona charters and financial chicanery in the think tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with David Wells, Research Director, Arizona Grand Canyon Institute, a think tank based in Phoenix. And my question, we've been talking about some of your work on charter schools, and I don't think you can leave the education issue without getting to what most parents would consider to be the fundamental thing. What do we know about how these schools are performing relative to public schools?
Well, it varies a lot. So first of all, 46% of charters are not meeting current academic standards, and about half of the schools that are not meeting academic standards are charters. On the flip side, there's a whole bunch of...
46% of charters are not meeting academic standards. What's the comparable number in public schools?
It's about 200, and about half of them are charters, and about half of them are district schools, except there's a lot more district schools than there are charter schools.
The traditional public schools, on average, are doing better.
Yeah, in terms of that measure, yes. Yeah. Because essentially you've got with charter schools is a lot of them deal with some kids who are struggling in school and credit recoveries. And then, a lot of these college prep ones like Great Hearts and Bases.
That's what I when I look at that, so somebody does evaluation research, I know it depends on what the base is, what the pool is. And if you have, if you have struggling schools, I'll guarantee you in almost every case, those are schools from poor neighborhoods.
Right. Yeah. And I think Great Hearts is a really good example of that because they have a very strong college prep curriculum. They do their finances, we think, pretty well. They have one school in Maryvale, which is a very high poverty area. And unlike their other schools, which are almost all considered A schools, but they also have, higher socioeconomic students there. The one in Maryvale gets a C grade from the state, which is very similar to what the Cartwright Elementary School District, which is the
comparable.
Cartwright does have one A school, the idea is that it's really more challenging. Those students need a lot more resources, and there's no magic pill that even the charters that we think are doing generally a good job, they can't just simply fix some of the challenges that we have with poverty. And overall, when people will see the aggregate AZ merit scores, and they'll always, and the charter association will always say, hey, our scores are higher than district scores, and our concerned with that is because you can't... It's not apples to apples because what you need to basically provide your own transportation to get to a charter school. So generally what we've found is that we think that charters are getting slightly higher income students, the family, and as a consequence...
Because it's students who have the ability to transport themselves.
Right. Their parents are able to do that.
Not only income maybe, but two-parent family. Who can take their kids to school. Two-parent families is probably a big plus in that area.
Right. And there are a number of charters that have really focused in on that college prep kind of curriculum. Yeah. So they're sort of creaming from the top, too.
And I've seen that. I mean, I remember interviewing one student at one of the very top prep schools, and they went through this process with them in the ninth grade where they sit them down and they say, listen, you're going to work your backside off in this school, and you need to think about that, because if you're not prepared to, you know, stay up all night every night working and all that, you probably shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, within a pool of already very good students, they wanted to keep only the ones that were willing to work extremely hard. Well, of course they're going to outperform any other entity because the pool they're working with, in which I think you have, and this gets a little wonky, but it, as you know, it is the thing. Well, I don't think we've ever had is a true randomized control experiment. In other words, where you took the same pool of kids and then you randomly assign half of them to one kind of school and you randomly assign the other half. No self-selection involved, because when you get parents who take in the initiative to move their kids somewhere, on average, they're either higher income or more motivated. There's something about them that's a little bit different, even if it's just that the parents get it a little bit more that education is important. But if you take a pool of kids that are whatever pool they are and randomly assign them to two groups, don't mess with any everything else, assure they're equivalent in every other respect, then and only then can you take the differences in performance and relate that to the quality of the school.
Right, and there's only one entity that's tried to do something similar to that by getting sort of anonymous student data. Mm-hmm. It's the Center for Research on Educational Outcomes, which is a part of Stanford University. And what they found in Arizona is that, in general, district schools perform a bit better than charter schools. That doesn't mean every charter school is worse than a district
school. Well, and the charter school has a wider range generally, doesn't it? In other words, the good ones are very good and the bad ones are really bad.
So what they do is they control for geography and then they try to control for as many demographics as they can. And they sort of try to make an apples-to-apples comparison. And when they've done that for Arizona, they've found, and again, their data is still about 6 years old or something like that. They've generally found that district schools performed a bit better. And they found the online charters, I think there were 3 out of 4, which were just dreadful. And in fact, students might not be learning anything. Those are some really, and those are nationwide concerns we've had. And that's why we're going to focus a lot on trying to improve online charters.
Yeah. Anecdotally, I've heard there are some kids, it's a small number for whom that may make some sense. But it's hard to maintain the level of motivation and control.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think for well-motivated kids, it's great. For kids who already were struggling in a traditional environment, you know, just putting them in front of a computer is not going to help unless there's a lot of support to make sure that they're really engaging the curriculum and are able to figure out questions and so forth.
This is the other question I wanted to ask you about the financing of schools. The thing that has never made any sense to me, we are pumping extra money. We rate our schools A, B, C, D, E, F. And we pump extra bonus money into the A schools, saying you've done a great job. This is a reward. Isn't that completely backwards?
Yes. There's the kids who need the most added resources, and we really would like to see this, are the kids in the low-income schools, because they're the ones who may have to deal with their families being evicted, or they may have a family member incarcerated. They have all different things going on, or they've got maybe a single parent who's got odd hours and so forth. So these are the kids who need a lot of support, and maybe the parents didn't go to college. So those are the kids that need the most support. And right now, as a state, don't actually provide really any difference. We don't have a poverty weight in the way in which we fund schools.
And in other words, the poverty weight, that's a technical term. Yeah. I think what that means, if just clear what you're saying, is we don't assign extra dollars to schools based on certain kinds of needs that you're going to have that are going to be associated with poverty.
That's right.
If you're in a high poverty area, the kids are going to have more of all kinds of other problems. And any educator who's ever taught in any diversity of schools will tell you that. You know, in the poor areas, you're going to have, you know, if you got broken homes and you got a whole lot of other stuff going on, the schools need to be more resourced to deal with that before they can even get near education. We deal with that on the nutrition end. I mean, we provide school lunches. That's, I think, and that's federal money. I think that's one area where we do that, and we've addressed that concern.
Right, and they also get some Title I money from the federal government, but it's not nearly enough to really bridge the gap. And in Arizona, when they compare us to other states, we're really basically funding all the schools about the same. And we need to do a better job of funding the low-income schools, because we could get a huge improvement in our high school graduation rates and really improve the state, tremendously by really focusing a lot more resources on those.
The model of giving more money to the A schools, that only makes sense if you really believe that the problem is that the teachers aren't trying hard enough in those other schools. And if only they would try harder, the schools would. If that was what was going on, then the extra money for the A schools would make sense. But I think if you think about what's really happening, that's downright laughable.
Right. And it's the example of Great Hearts is, I think, a great example of that. I mean, I think their teachers are trying hard in all of their schools. And just because Maryville has a C doesn't mean that they're doing C effort. They're probably doing A effort in all the schools. It's just that they have a much bigger bridge to try to cross in Maryville in terms of helping those students be as successful as possible.
How much would it take? I think one of your research projects dealt with that. And what kind of level of resources would it take to get a bang for the buck in the low-end performing schools?
So trying to be pragmatically reasonable in Arizona, what we'd like to see is basically 10% more money. So about $800 to $850 more per student for kids who are from poverty. And that we think would be enough to at least close the gap by at least one-third between where they're at and where the state average is at.
And you've related that to actual performance. You've seen data that suggests that you can get a performance increase. Because everybody, this is the argument against it. Well, throwing money at it isn't the answer.
Yeah, and we've seen there's nationwide data, and there's a lot of nationwide data that shows that when you put resources into low-income schools, you get the most results because those kids can really benefit the most from both having high-quality teachers, having slightly smaller classes when possible, and also the outside supports that can be really critical for those students to be even more successful in school. When you can provide those things, and we underfund our schools in general in Arizona, so when we can do that, especially better for those kids, they'll do a lot better.
I keep coming back. This is an anecdote, but I thought it was a very thoughtful one. My kid, when he was in middle school, I went and guest lectured his class. It was a highly advanced district-wide school. And I started talking to the teacher. I said, let me talk to you about this class side of its business. Does it really matter? And he said to me, in this class, I've got kids that are highly motivated. They sit down. They're ready to work. They don't have any problem. I could probably take a few more in this class. But there's other classes where the kids are bouncing off the wall and have all kinds of problems. He says, In a class like that, I couldn't handle half of what I have in here. In other words, but we've got this formula that treats every class size as if it's one thing. And his answer, which I thought made just eminent sense, it depends on the kind of kids you got in the class. And the more problems the kid, and this is where I presume you're talking about getting a bigger impact in the poverty schools. You got more kids with problems. That's where you're going to get the big payoff from smaller class sizes.
That's right.
So we will be back. We will talk to Dave Wells about another subject that the Grand Canyon Institute has been working on, and that is the subject of unemployment insurance. We will return with him in just a few minutes in the Think Tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Dr. Dave Wells. He's the research director for the Grand Canyon Institute, an Arizona-based think tank. We have talked mostly about charter schools because, frankly, charter schools and education has been what most of your work has been over the last couple of years. But far from all of it. And the other thing, you have a study just coming out right now on the subject of unemployment insurance in Arizona. Talk to me about what you found.
Well, you might think we don't need to worry about unemployment insurance because so many people have jobs right now. But in fact, what we want to make a point is we'd like to see the legislature address this issue before people lose jobs.
Can we, by the way, backtrack and talk about the system? What is unemployment insurance? How does it work? Who pays for it?
So unless you're self-employed, in which case you're not covered, but what happens is your employer pays a very small tax, and that goes into an unemployment insurance fund.
I can tell you that's between 0.1% and 3.5%, depending on your history.
Right, right. And it's on, and in Arizona,
if you fire people all the time and lay people off all the time, you're going to look at that 3.5%.
Right, and it's on, and it's paid actually in Arizona the first $7,000 of wages for everybody, and but the and then the idea is if you lose a job through no fault of your own, so if you quit, you don't get it, but so you have to actually lose it through no fault of your own, and then you would qualify for unemployment compensation. And in general, the idea behind it is that they would provide about half of your former income, which is really helpful because when you lose your job, you have to deal with how do you keep your health benefits, which might mean you have to have COBRA payments. A lot of people don't have a lot of savings. And then you also have all the stress and all the challenges that go on.
Well, the insurance is a big part. You are typically not getting, unless you have a fat package. Most people don't. Most people lose their health insurance at the end of the month.
Right. So if they take, if they have a COBRA, they can pay for it themselves.
COBRA is not cheap.
Yeah, so it's a very difficult time financially for people, mm-hmm. and then you want to think about, you know, if you've got kids and all the different challenges, and if you're renting, how do you keep paying for the rent? So, and a lot of people don't have a lot saved, so that unemployment compensation is really critical for that. And unfortunately, Arizona has been a laggard in unemployment compensation. So essentially, the worst states are Mississippi, Alabama, and Arizona.
And what's the top payment here in Arizona?
So the most you can get is $240 a week, which means that if you make more than $25,000 a year, you're going to get a lot less than half of your.
So $25,000 a year, the point where you're at that high level where you get the $240 a week.
Right, and if you're above that, you'll still get $240, but if you're currently making $50,000 a year, it's only going to be 25% of what you've been making, mm-hmm. and, you know, and that's a significant thing. And this is insurance. This is supposed to help protect you. And then the other thing in Arizona is it's also the hardest state to actually get it. So, for instance, we're the only state in the country. The minimum wage in Arizona is now $12 an hour. If you have been working consistently for 25 hours a week, you won't qualify for unemployment insurance in Arizona because they will say you haven't done enough hours of work.
How many hours do you need?
Essentially, they require essentially the average of 30 hours a week is what they've put into it. And it was a
So if you're a part-time guy at 25 hours a week, you're laid off, you don't get unemployment insurance.
Right.
Or is it only if it's at that level? What if you're a $50,000 a year person working 25 hours a week? Do you qualify?
Well, no, yeah, right. If you have a higher income level,
it's based on the gross wages.
Right. But the thing is, the people who really need it are people who have, especially need it are low-wage folks.
$12 an hour, 25 hours a week, you're below the threshold for getting a nickel.
Right. Yeah, and it's because the legislature passed a law that tied it in part to the minimum wage in terms of the money amount.
Okay, let's put somebody at minimum wage, $12 an hour, working full-time, 40 hours a week. They get laid off. What kind of check are they going to get?
They'll get a check. There's a formula for it, but so they'll probably get in the neighborhood of about maybe $180 a week if my math's okay.
So it's a narrow range. That person gets 180 and it caps at 240.
Yeah. So, and it might be a little bit more than that. I mean, if you're doing 40 hours a week, you're actually getting close to $24,000 a year.
$12 an hour. That's exactly what it is. That's 24,000. Yeah, so you're close to the cap. If you work 40 hours a week.
Yeah. So effectively the cap is at minimum wage. That's just problematic. And so,
of course, the cap was set when minimum wage was well below $12 an hour.
Yes. And so what we'd say is, like, why don't you just adopt what a state like Texas is doing? Texas and you could talk about Utah, Nevada, a lot of other states that are very Colorado, they're all very similar to this. And essentially, their cap is more like $450 a week. And it's usually because they're looking, and we think it should be based on the census does a thing called the average weekly wage of covered workers. And that's in the neighborhood of, you know, $900 to $1,000 mm-hmm. a week. And if you make the cap just half of that, then it's automatically going to adjust over time because we haven't even adjusted this in 16 years in Arizona or 15 years. And Carolyn Allen, one of our founding board members, was one of the people who was really instrumental in getting it increased. And so we should have this sort of tracked so it happens automatically. And we need to make it easier for people to, if you're working 25 hours a week, you ought to be able to get unemployment compensation because your employer's paying the taxes for you. You just can't access the benefits. Mm-hmm. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. So that's what we want to see. And again, and this is a very small tax of payroll. It's actually about 0.4%.
That's the average
of the overall payroll.
I told you the range before, that's essentially that is based on your experience. In other words, if you lay off people, if there are businesses that work on that model, I'll hire in a lot of people when I need them, then I'll lay them all off. And if you're creating unemployment like that, you are paying a much higher percentage than you're saying the average across all industries, 0.4%.
Yeah, if you look at of their whole payroll. So it's a really small tax.
Of the whole payroll, this rate is only applied to the first $7,000.
Right.
And so if you're paying 3% of $7,000 and somebody's making 70, you're really paying 0.3% of their total wage.
Right. So it's a really small tax. We think that taxable amount probably should be higher.
Well, the one way to do is to increase the rate. The other is to increase the base on which that is applied and has the same effect to the employer.
So, but the net effect is like even if this if the cost to employers went up by 50%, that's still on their payroll, that's going to be no more than 0.6%. So it's a really small amount. And relative to the benefits, this gains. Because I say families are going to be really vulnerable. We're going to have a recession. I mean, people would like to think that we've gotten rid of recessions. But when that happens, over 100,000 Arizonans are going to lose their job through no fault of their own, through what's called cyclical unemployment. They've been working hard, but their businesses won't be able to afford them. And they're going to lose their job, and they're going to need help, and they should have an insurance program that at least provides half of their wages, at least up to people earning at least maybe roughly $50,000 a year.
It's interesting that you're proposing this now in relatively good times. Usually, this only becomes an issue when the recession hits and a lot of people are more out of work.
It will become an issue, but we want people to be proactive. We think that's a better policy idea. Think about what's going to happen and get ready for that rainy day. We're doing it at the budget level. We got $1 billion in the rainy day fund. What about those unemployed workers when they're going to need it?
Oh. Thank you very much. Dave Wells, Research Director, Arizona Grand Canyon Institute.
Thank you.
We'll be back on another topic next week in the think tank.